Good afternoon. Good afternoon. I'll ask for people to please silence their cell phones. That would be helpful. Thank you. We are in Yeshaya Yud Tet, chapter 19. I initially hoped that I would also get into 20 today, but it's not happening. We'll be content with Yud Tet. Last week, we introduced the perek. We introduced this chapter, and it's really 19 and 20 that we were introducing, by talking about the relationship between Egypt and the Jews, and how historically, if you go back to the beginning of the relationship, they are a symbol of all that we revile. Even though Abraham was told, you're going to have land in Egypt, we get out of Egypt and we're told, never go back there. And we have a mitzvah of not going back there. We talked about why, whether it's because of the fear that we will do this about face, of saying, well, let's go back to Egypt, whether it is because of a level of immorality associated with Egypt, or whether it is because Egypt represents self-reliance and turning away from God. We looked at different angles on it. And then we saw how that relationship between Egypt and the Jews continues in the time of the first Beis HaMikdash, the first temple, how they are a great regional power, and we are warned not to seek their help. We are supposed to seek the help of God instead. And we talked about that already from the time of Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, and how they nourished the enemies of King Solomon. But more substantively, when you get to the end of it, and we talked about the messages against looking to Egypt for help, a theme which is going to come back as we learn this chapter. And then we had the predictions for Mashiach, and for Mitzrayim, for Egypt, in the time of Mashiach, they will fall. And then the question of, are they also going to convert? Are they going to join the Jewish people? And so, what we get here in this chapter is a replay of Yitziat Mitzrayim, a replay of the Exodus from Egypt, with the themes that we see when the Jews get out of Egypt, leading up to that, so to speak, conversion to Judaism. And I'm waffling on conversion to Judaism here because it's not at all clear cut what exactly is that's going to happen to Egypt, both historically and eschatologically in terms of the time of Mashiach. Meaning, in neither case do we really understand what happens. And now we'll jump in eschatologically. Yes.
You said? I thought.
No, because you didn't hear. I said I had the E first. The question that I want to look at now to start us off, and it's really something we started to talk about at the end last time, but I want to restructure it a little bit, is the question of when is this supposed to happen? These events that we're going to describe here in chapter 19, when does this fall of Egypt and quasi-something conversion of Egypt actually takes place? When does it take place? So, yes, Susan. Oh, I'm not doing my job then. It should be very confused.
Oh, okay, I'm there. When we talk about the conversion, wasn't it supposed to be that we weren't supposed to have converting other people other than ourselves?
This has nothing to do with us converting them. This has to do with them coming to God.
Okay.
This is not about us going after them.
Their own...
Yeah.
It's from their own hearts.
Correct. Okay. Correct. The question of when Jews have sought converts and when they have not is an interesting question in its own right. But no, we're talking about their own impetus. Janine.
I'm just wondering how it should be seen as anything that has happened, because we've never seen that recognition of, like, we haven't seen it in time of the
Sweden. Is that true? Is that true that we've never seen Egypt convert to Judaism?
Uh-huh.
It wasn't in my history course in school. Well, wait and see. The first view, which we noted a little bit last time, and is the view that Rashi takes in the beginning of... Sorry? That Rashi takes in the beginning of our chapter, is that it is something that already happened. Happened already. It was when Egypt fell to the Assyrians, and then the Assyrians fell to Chizkiyahu. Take a look at source number one on the sheet, the Midrash in Seder Olam. After the fall of Sanherib, Chizkiyahu arose and freed the hosts who had come with Sanherib in chains. And they accepted the yoke of God's rule, fulfilling the prediction from our chapter. On that day there will be five cities, dot, dot, dot. We didn't get to the five cities yet, that's in our chapter. But the statement of this medrash is that after Sanherib's fall, well, when Sanherib invades, he will have with him officers from Ethiopia, officers from, nobility from Egypt, and Chizkiyahu is going to liberate them, and they are going to accept God. So it's not that the whole country converts to Judaism, but this population is going to convert, and we'll see how large the population is. We'll get to that. But they went and built an altar, brought burnt offerings upon it for heaven, and he quotes another passage from our chapter, on that day there will be an altar for God, and they prayed and bowed toward Jerusalem, and he quotes you, Yeshaya chapter 45, they will bow to you and pray to you, as we'll see when we get there. So Seder Olam is the source for the idea that the prediction is not all of Egypt, but a significant population is, from the standpoint of Yeshaya, is going to convert. From the standpoint of our history, has already converted. Happened after the fall of Sanherib. It's not the whole country, but it is a significant portion of the population. I brought you last time the other part of source number two. But now I'm bringing you Rabbi Meir's view. There are two views in source number two. This is the Gemara in Menachos about Chonio. So I'm trying to figure out how is best to do this, because I don't really want to read out source number two yet. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to explain source number two, but not read it out yet. There are two views there regarding when chapter 19 of Yeshaya came true. One view, which is the view of Rabbi Yehuda, we're not there yet, is with a temple associated with somebody by the name of Chonio. We'll talk about that. The other view, though, is Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir disagrees. He says that's not what it's talking about. It's the second paragraph in source number two. What did Rabbi Meir do with Rabbi Yehuda's verse? Rabbi Yehuda quotes a passage from our chapter about Egyptians building an altar to God and bringing sacrifices to God. So what is it that Rabbi Meir will understand that verse to be about if it's not about Chonio's temple? And we're told, as was taught, and it's our medrash from Seder Olam, after the fall of Sanherib, Chizkiyahu went and found princes sitting in gold wagons. Those are the princes who Sanherib had brought with him, the Egyptians and Ethiopians. He made them vow not to worship idols, as in Yeshaya 19:18. They went to Alexandria of Egypt, built an altar, brought offerings on it for heaven. And that's the way Rabbi Meir takes it. So Rabbi Meir, Talmudically, is on the same page as Seder Olam and says, this prediction already came true. Not only that, if you flip the page to Rashi, in number 5, no, you know what? Don't. It's okay. It's not the Rashi. No, because it's not going to add anything, and it's better to see that Rashi in a little bit, or a lot bit, as the case may be. But that's your first view. What Yeshaya is predicting here is the conversion of some population within Egypt when they are impressed by the fall of Sanherib at Jerusalem, and Chizkiyahu sets them free. That's your first take. The second take is the temple in Elephantine, which we talked about a little bit in Ezra at one point. The temple in Elephantine is subject to a lot of confusion, much of which is mine, but I think I got it straight. There was a temple in Elephantine in Egypt. If you want to know how to spell it, it's elephant plus I-N-E. It was at the end of the 5th century before the Common Era, which means, depending on whose chronology you're using, it's early in the Second Temple period. If you take the secular chronology, it's about 100 years into it. If you take the traditional Jewish Seder Olam chronology, it's in the opening decades of the Second Temple period. Either way, this is not a halachic Beit HaMikdash. This is not a temple that we would recognize as a kosher temple. The sacrifices that they are bringing there are illegal under Jewish law. Your sacrifices belong in the temple in Jerusalem, not anywhere else. They do not have a prophet who tells them this is the place where you're supposed to do this and break all the rules that we've ever had for how sacrifices work. The Professor Mordechai Zer Kavod, in the Da'at Mikra edition of Ezra and Nehemiah, particularly in Appendix 2, brings papyri from the Persian period, from Elephantine. In Aramaic, they're known, Elephantine is known as Yev. Yev. Yud Bet. Or if you wanted to write in English letters, Y-E-B. Maybe J-E-B, maybe Jeb, I don't know. But I don't think he'd be in Egypt, he'd be in Tennessee. Yev. Or Florida. But in any case, the Yev equals Elephantine. And the papyri there are about decrees of the government allowing the Jews of Elephantine who want to rebuild their temple because it's been destroyed by locals, saying you're allowed to do this, you're allowed to bring grain offerings, but you're not allowed to bring animal offerings. Doesn't explain why, but that's the decree. I brought for you here, actually, in number 3. I forgot that I had put it on the sheet. From the Center for Online Jewish Studies, the Elephantine Temple, you see that? So there I brought you an article about it. I don't think I'm going to read it out. I think you can read English. Sorry?
In Egypt,
yes. Elephantine is in Egypt, that's correct. Yes. Yeah. So it had a Jewish community, and they wanted to, and they had. They built a temple. Again, no one claims that this was legal. No one claims this was what was supposed to be. There's actually a book called The Theological Dictionary of the Old Testaments, which, if you're not scared off by the name, you know, has interesting things to say. So it floats the idea that this prohibition against bringing animal sacrifice was meant to ensure the supremacy of the temple in Jerusalem. Because there, we could bring animal sacrifices. Who knows? But that's your second historic option for the conversion of Egypt. But it's pretty clear to me that this isn't it. Because it was illegal. Yeshaya is not predicting this wondrous conversion to God in a way that's contra halacha, that's against halacha. So this can't be it. The third possibility, yes.
Was this Elephantine temple built by Jews or by
Jews? Jews. Yeah.
So
absolutely. The best heresies are Jewish. Nothing.
But then it's not a conversion.
Right. Well, no, except that the Egyptians funded and helped with it, and maybe there were Egyptians who joined in. But again, no one seriously considers that this is a fulfillment of Yeshaya's prophecy. The third view, and this is Rabbi Yehuda in this discussion in source number 2, Rabbi Yehuda's view, and we mentioned it last week, we read it last week, is that actually it is the temple of Chonio. Chonio, again, being the son of Shimon HaTzadik. If you remember Shimon HaTzadik from Pirkei Avos, right? The one of the last of the great assembly, the Anshei Knesset HaGedola. So Chonio is his son. Now, if he is a son of someone who was one of the last of that great assembly, so you're talking about basically third generation, maybe fourth, of the Second Temple. So after Elephantine. And this temple that Chonio built is attested to not only from the Talmudic account, which we mentioned last week at the end, but also from Josephus. Josephus testifies to the existence of this temple. Some people claim it was in Alexandria. Josephus says it was in Leontopolis. I have no idea. I couldn't tell you. I've never been to either one. But they get different backstories for it. What we read last week, at the end of last week, was that there was a rivalry between the two sons of Shimon HaTzadik, who had been the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, regarding who was going to become high priest next. So the version you have on your sheet in source number 2 is Rabbi Meir's version of the story. And in Rabbi Meir's version of the story, Shimon had said Chonio, his son, is going to be the Kohen Gadol, but it was his younger son. And the older brother, Shimi, was very upset. And so he sabotaged Chonyo. He got Chonyo to go out in a way that looked like he was desecrating the service. The other Kohanim want to kill him, and he runs away to Egypt, and he brings offerings for Avodah Zarah, for idolatry. In other words, it's an illegal, inappropriate temple going on in Egypt. That's Rabbi Meir's view. Rabbi Yehuda disagrees. He has the same starting point, that there's a rivalry going on between the brothers. But his conclusion is, Chonyo's temple was actually with offerings for God, and that the goal was to bring sacrifice and to fulfill this prediction of Yeshaya, the prediction of Isaiah. That's the way that Rabbi Yehuda reads it. So it's a temple for God. Now, you'll ask me, didn't you just tell me you're not allowed to bring sacrifices in Egypt?
Yes, you did.
But it's still Second Temple, period. Like, why would we think that that was okay? So there is a source which I thought I had brought on the sheet. Oh, I did, but it's in number 17, because I'm not ready for it yet, I guess. But he's going to resolve it. Number 17 is going to resolve the question of how this could be justified. I'll tell you right now, just because we're not going to get to 17 today, I have a feeling. But the answer is that Tosfot asks that question. Tosfot commenting on the Talmud, and he says that maybe non-Jews would be allowed to bring sacrifices there. It could be Jews. They're told your sacrifices have to be in Jerusalem, but the non-Jews would be allowed to build and to bring a sacrifice to God somewhere else. And that's the easy answer to the problem of how that could be legit. So those are three different explanations of when this comes true. First view is when Sancheirib is defeated. Second view is Elephantine, but no one really takes that seriously. Third view is Chonyo's temple, and I almost skipped but caught myself. Josephus's account is fascinating. If you look at source number 4, his account of this temple has a very different backstory. He does not read it as Chonyo, the would-be high priest who ran away and brought sacrifices to God. Take a look at this. He says, this is from his Antiquities of the Jews, book 13. It also appears in Wars of the Jews, book 7. He says, about the year 149, before the Common Era. But then the son of Onias the high priest, so he has, he's not the son of Shimon HaTzadik, but the grandson of Shimon HaTzadik, son of Chonyo, Onias is Chonyo, who is of the same name with his father, and who fled to King Ptolemy, who was called Philo or Philometer, I don't know, lived now at Alexandria. As we have said already, he had fled out of fear from Antiochus. When this Chonyo saw that Judea was oppressed by the Macedonians and their kings, out of a desire to purchase to himself a memorial and eternal fame, he resolved to send to King Ptolemy and Queen Cleopatra to ask leave of them that he might build a temple in Egypt like to that at Jerusalem, and might ordain Levites and priests out of their own stock. The chief reason why he was desirous so to do was that he relied upon the prophet Isaiah, who lived above 600 years before and foretold that there certainly was to be a temple built to Almighty God in Egypt by a man that was a Jew. Onias was elevated with this prediction and wrote the following epistle to Ptolemy and Cleopatra. Having done many and great things for you in the affairs of the war by the assistance of God, and that in Celesyria and Phoenicia, I came at length with the Jews to Leontopolis and to other places of your nation, where I found that the greatest part of your people had temples in an improper manner, and that on this account they bore ill will against one against another, which happens to the Egyptians by reason of the multitude of their temples and the difference of opinions about divine worship. Yeah, they have all these multiple gods and temples, and they don't know what they're doing. Now, I found a very fit place in a castle that hath its name from the country Diana. This place is full of materials of several sorts and replenished with sacred animals. I desire, therefore, that you will grant me leave to purge this holy place, which belongs to no master and has fallen down, and to build there a temple to Almighty God after the pattern of that in Jerusalem, and of the same dimensions. That may be for the benefit of thyself, thy wife, and children, that those Jews which dwell in Egypt may have a place whither they may come and meet together in mutual harmony one with another, and be subservient to thy advantages. For the prophet Isaiah foretold there should be an altar in Egypt to the Lord God, and many other such things did he prophesy relating to that place. And that was what Chonyo wrote to King Ptolemy. Now one may observe his, meaning Ptolemy's, piety, and that of his sister and wife Cleopatra's. By that, I'm not getting into that. By that epistle which they wrote in answer to it, for they laid the blame and the transgression of the law upon the head of Chonio, and this was their reply. King Ptolemy and Queen Cleopatra, to Chonio send greeting. We have read thy petition, wherein thou desirest leave to be given thee to purge that temple which has fallen down at Leontopolis, on which account we cannot but wonder that it should be pleasing to God to have a temple erected in a place so unclean and so full of sacred animals. But since thou sayest that Isaiah the prophet foretold this long ago, we give thee leave to do it, if it may be done according to your law, and so that we may not appear to have at all offended God herein. So, if this is the wrong thing to do, it's on your head. We're good with it. We're going to satisfy Isaiah. So Chonio took the place, built a temple, an altar to God, like indeed to that in Jerusalem, but smaller and poorer. And he says, I'm not going to get into the dimensions and the vessels, so I did that already in Wars of the Jews. So that's your third, is Chonio's temple, whichever account you're going to take for how it is, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, or Josephus. Josephus, in general, lacks a degree of credibility because he likes to play to the Romans. He likes to write whatever he thinks the Romans are going to adopt. But I don't have a clear account from the Talmud because I have two opposite views between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda. Right? They may share the idea that Chonio was some kind of a runaway, but they're very different. One of them believes that it was for idolatry, and the other one believes that it was meant for God. So, I don't know. But this is certainly seen by some, specifically by Rabbi Yehuda and Josephus, as a fulfillment of the prophecy that we see here in our chapter. And then the last view is the one that I presented at the end last time, which is Abarbanel. And Abarbanel says, stop trying to identify this with moments within history. This is a future thing. This is something for the time of Mashiach. It has not happened yet. And he goes through the elements of chapter 19 and he says, we've never seen this. We've never seen the Nile dry up. We've never seen all of these wonders that you're talking about. Clearly it's meant for the time of Mashiach. It is not a parable. It is literal. And it is going to happen at some point in the future. Clear? Okay. So what we've learned here, or at least what I've learned here at any rate, trying to make some sense of, is it's to me it's fascinating, is this relationship between the Jews and Egypt is ongoing, centuries long. You have at least two different temples that were built to the God of Israel. Right? In some sense, in some way, people are bringing sacrifices during the Second Temple period in Egypt. I think that's a fascinating thing in its own right. So let's see the chapter now. Let's actually look at what this prediction is. It begins with the sort of de rigueur prediction of the fall of Egypt. So we're chapter 19. It's on page 983 if you're using the Stone Tanakh. We're going to see the opening three verses, which are, fairly routine as things go. Masa Mitzrayim, right? Masa, the way that this prophecy begins, like the other predictions of punishment, it is a burden, it is a weight, it's a prediction of harm against Egypt. Hine Hashem rochev al ad kal. God is riding in on a swift cloud, right? The image of swift arrival, much like the swift arrival of the messengers in the previous chapter, suggests a degree of certainty. This is going to happen. Think Joseph telling Pharaoh, Memaher ha'elokim la'asoto, God is hastening to fulfill, in that case, the dreams that Paro had. So God is going to come in on a speedy cloud. Uva Mitzrayim, he's going to come to Egypt. V'na'u elilei Mitzrayim mipanav ulevav Mitzrayim yimas bikirbo. The idols of Egypt are going to tremble before him. The heart of Egypt will melt within him. V'sichsachti, which is such a good word. V'sichsachti, Mitzrayim b'Mitzrayim. What does sichsachti mean?
Make them fight.
Make them fight. Sick. Too sick. You're going to sick Egypt against Egypt. I don't know the etymology of the word sick like that, but I'll go with sichsachti. I am going to set Egypt against Egypt. V'nilchamu ish be'achiv ish b're'eyu. They're going to fight against each other. Ir be'ir, city against city, mamlacha be'mamlacha, one region with its own control against another one. They have different principalities, and they will battle each other. V'navka ruach Mitzrayim b'kirbo v'atzaso avaleya. And the spirit of Egypt is going to literally become hollow, is the way that the commentaries tend to take it. It's going to become hollow in itself. V'atzaso avaleya, I will cause its counsel to be swallowed up. V'darshu el ha'elilim ve'el ha'itim ve'el ha'ovos ve'el ha'yidonim. They're going to go to their idols, they're going to go to the sorcerers, they're going to go to the magicians, and they will not have any answer. That's your opening, that's your introduction here. Very interesting note, which Rashi and Abarbanel pick up on. We've now seen how many different predictions of the fall of nations within this region. Right? I didn't give the overall introduction to the book that I've been doing all along in the beginning today. But this section started in chapter 13. We saw the fall of Babylon. We saw the fall of the Plishtim. We saw the fall of Moab. We saw the fall of Aram. We saw the fall of Yisrael. Right? Never once did we talk about what's going to happen to their idols. It was all about them. Why did we suddenly throw this in here? Why the Egyptian idols? I've been talking for 26 minutes. Oh boy. What should this say to us? No, the fall of the Egyptian idols. Yes, Susan.
Does this go back to what we were talking about with Egypt having all the influence on the Jews, that it's their idols that have to go because they've been the ones that put what we believe?
Right, so one way to look at it is the temptation of Egypt's idols for us. And this is an undermining of that which had been a threat to us. Good, that's one way to take it. Rebecca.
Is it possibly hearkening back to our first encounter in Egypt, where there also was a god showing up or showing that their idols were false?
Right. So the other way to look at it is that this is a piece of that replay of Yitziat Mitzrayim, of the Exodus from Egypt. Abarbanel sees this as the first piece of evidence to show that that's what this is a replay of. If you take a look on your sheet now, it's verse number 6. I'll come back to number 5. Abarbanel writes, Shekmosha b'yitziat Mitzrayim asa HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'Elohehem Shvatim. No, that's not Shemos, that's their gods, lowercase g. Just as when we left Egypt, God punished their gods, las kachalas ilavo b'churbanas, so too in the future when Egypt is destroyed, v'inyan mishpata Elohus, and this judgment of their gods, hu sheyisbatlu hashva'osehem me'al Mitzrayim, is that their influence upon Egypt will cease. So God did it to them then, and he does it to them in this prediction as well. Rashi makes the same observation that it's a replay of what happened before, but gives you a different explanation. Rashi number 5. He says, "V'zeh shamar anavi poranus Mitzrayim b'lashon hazeh mashalo amar b'lashon hazeh l'shar umos." The fact that Yeshaya talks about this type of suffering for Egypt, which he didn't do with the other nations, "Mibnei shem lemudim lilkos b'midah hazos," is because they were used to this. This happened to them before. And he quotes you the pasuk, "V'avarti be'eretz Mitzrayim u'b'chol elohei Mitzrayim eseh shvatim." So he says, "V'derech eretz miyar'ines ha'adam b'makash shekvar lakabai." He says it's very intimidating to somebody when you warn them about something they experienced in the past and that they suffered from in the past, you know, that's going to happen to you again. That's a very intimidating thing. Of course, he's not really talking to Egypt. He's talking to us. Nonetheless, Susan.
If we take this as a Barbanel's prophecy of the future.
Well, Yeshaya's prophecy of the future. Barbanel's many things.
Barbanel's
prophecy.
No, I mean his explanation of the prophecy. Today they're Muslims, and we don't consider Muslims idol worship, from what I understand. It's considered a monotheistic still religion. So doesn't that kind of negate?
That's a really interesting question, is how would this play out in the time of Mashiach if they in fact don't have foreign gods at this stage? Well, I want to answer the first one.
Okay,
you ask me the second one and then we'll come back to the first one.
The word called, I always thought that easy. I didn't
Right, so it's both. Kal is something that is light and therefore moves swiftly and therefore can be used for something that is easy as well. But in terms of your first question, I think that's interesting. I mean, the Copts, I suppose, could claim that, you know, they are Egypt. And there's this very significant Christian population living there. And it's, you know, unquestionably for Jews, Christianity is idolatry. Whether it's idolatrous for a non-Jew to join God with others, you know, is a much bigger question and more complicated question. But for sure, for Jews, Christianity is idolatry. Any of them that is going to involve a Trinity, any of them that's going to involve joining God with others or giving him any sort of human form, is going to be out. Whether it is for a non-Jew is a separate discussion. That's debatable, and that will very much depend on which version of Christianity one is talking about. But you'd have to have like an ultra-Unitarian type of thing for it to be anything other than idolatry for a Jew. It would be very hard. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, because I'm not a Christian scholar, but I think it would be hard to find. At that point, they might as well just become Jewish. But in terms of your question and what this means for the future, the answer could well be that there's another shift coming before the time of Mashiach. That would be one answer. Another answer could be that since fundamentally Islam may not constitute idolatry because they believe in an incorporeal one God who created the universe, nonetheless, the statement that Muhammad is the last prophet and that the Torah that we have is not authentic, if not idolatry in the literal sense, is still a foreign religion, and maybe the answer would be that this refers to that. I think it's a good question, but that may be the answer. Okay. So the vision of the collapse of Egypt, Malbim throws in a very interesting line, which I looked up the meteorology on this, and I'm not really so sure. But he says, the description of God arriving on a swift cloud, he says the cloud itself is harmful for Egypt because the rains are harmful. Having rain there is harmful. So that's certainly not true contemporarily. Meaning they rely on winter rains to augment what they get out of the Nile. It could be that historically there was a time when it wasn't so, but for sure now it's not so, and they're looking increasingly to rainfall as something very important there.
Could we be talking about like flooding, because they have so much water already that even more they don't need.
Right, but they need winter rains, and they don't want rains out of season, but no one in the Middle East wants rains out of season.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Paul?
I know that Yeshayahu is a poet, and I know that language for effect, but the idea of God riding on a swift cloud,
yes,
is very striking, to say the least, in terms of our being an incorporeal God.
Yeah.
So how do you square that?
Parable. That wouldn't bother me any more than the many, many other examples that Yeshaya and others will use to describe God in visual terms. Yeshaya is, as you said in the beginning, he's a poet, and he's speaking to a group that he wants to have envision something for the future. This is a message to them, remember, that's meant to reinforce his prose message of don't look for allies in these nations around you, rely on God. And so he needs that kind of vivid image of God is riding in on a swift cloud. I have no idea what that looks like, but I can still visualize it.
It's
true.
From a literary perspective, from a rhetorical perspective, but as a religious or theological perspective.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, but that's the bigger question about such usages in Tanakh as a whole. So that's your introduction. The collapse of Egypt, the collapse of their gods, they're fighting against each other, but the main image here is the Nile-based agriculture in shambles. And that's what's coming in sentences 4 to 10. It's a fairly straight read, but it's really remarkable. So if you're using the stone, you want to jump over onto 985 at this point. V'sikarti es Mitzrayim biyad Adonim kasha. This is one of those cases where Yeshaya is just the king of language. You look at this and you're like, wow, how did he do that? What does the word v'sikarti mean? Sorry?
Yeah,
To put a dam. To dam up something. Right? I am going to dam up Egypt, right? In the hands of harsh masters. But he's referring in this whole section to the Nile. So he uses a Nile image, Visi Karti, to talk about what he's going to do to the Egyptians. It's Yeshaya does this and just moves on. You know, he's not going to sit there and admire his handiwork. He doesn't he just does it and expects the reader to understand what he's doing. So I'm going to dam them up in the hands of harsh masters. Umelech azim shalbam, a mighty king is going to rule over them. Ne'um ha'adon Hashem tzvakos, this is the word of God. God signs his name. V'nishesu mayim mehayam, v'nahar yechrav v'yavesh, and water will dry up from the sea, the river will dry up. V'heiznichu neharos. And the rivers, he'eznichu, the term Zayin Nunchet is a term that usually is associated with abandonment. So the rivers will be abandoned. Dalalu v'charvu ya'orei matzor. The matzor is usually a siege, but matzor is also Mitzrayim, right? So all of the Nile and all of the rivers, they are all going to become weak and dry up. Kaneva suf kamelu. The reeds are going to be gone. The reeds are going to wither. Aros al ya'or al pi ya'or. Aros is often read either as something, as there will be exposure on the Yaor because all the vegetation will dry up, or Aros is the vegetation itself. But either way, what it's trying to say is that the plant life on the Nile is going to dry up. V'chol mizra Yaor yivash nidav ve'enenu, all that is planted there will disappear. V'anu hadayagim, anu like the word onin. So the anu hadayagim, the fishermen are going to grieve. I'm sorry?
No, I just
said. Okay. V'avlu, and they will be in mourning. Kol mashlichei bayor chaka, all those who throw hooks into the river, meaning the fishermen. Uforsei michmores al pneimayim umlalu, and all those who spread their traps and their nets on the water, all of them will be cut off. Uvoshu ovdei pishtim sirikos ve'orgim choroi. This is a reference either to the people who make nets to catch the fish, or people who grow flax near the water and then use the flax. But either way, they are going to be cut off. The fishing industry suffers. The net weavers suffer. The hayu, the last sentence in this section, v'hayu shasoseha medukaim, and all of its foundations are going to be weakened. Kol osei secher, there's that word again, this time with a sin instead of a samach, but it's the same word. Kol osei secher, all those who make dams. And then here's another one. This is just Yeshaya. Agmei nafesh. What letter should be changed in those two words? The aleph should be an ayin. Agmat nefesh. Agmat nefesh is pain of the soul. When a person is aggravated, when a person is upset. But he uses it here to describe the damage done to the waterways. This is a pun. The agmat nefesh with an ayin to refer to grief appears in Iyov, in Job chapter 30. But here, agam nefesh is a pond that people go to relax. So the agme nefesh will dry up, causing agmat nefesh. It's really something the way that he does. I'm just in awe that someone can do that with language. But this vision of the Nile is so striking. The damage to the Nile, Radak says in number 7, that Radak has a problem because unlike Abarbanel, he believes this happened historically. And of course, we never saw such a thing. That was what led Abarbanel to say, this is about the Mashiach time. But Radak says no. Source number 7, he says, the prophecies mentioned of the drying of the river and the halting of their sustenance therefrom is a parable. For the Nile River irrigates the land such that they don't need rain. And from the river come to them great amounts of fish. He says, it's just devastation. That's all it is. Whereas Abarbanel says, no, it's not just devastation because there's no nimshal. There's no point where it comes out of the parable and says, okay, this is actually referring to. That's what drives Abarbanel. So what Abarbanel says, just one second, Meir, I'll get to you. What Abarbanel does with that is to say that this is the second step in replaying Yitziat Mitzrayim. Meaning, when we left Egypt, we had Mako, we had plagues, which specifically involved damage to the Nile. Right? First you had Nayam Suf, the Nile. You had Makat Dam, blood, where the water turns to blood. Then you had Tzfardea, where the frogs come jumping out of the water. So the striking of the water is a replay now. This is the second phase in replaying Yitziat Mitzrayim, replaying the Exodus. Yes?
Okay, I don't know, it's just striking me that a lot of this is showing political sharpness.
Yeah.
Okay? How you win a war, you win it by cutting off people's sustenance and breaking down the economy. And of course, if you damage the Nile,
absolutely,
Egypt is finished. We still do things like that if you look around and hear what people are saying. I'm not even going to quote Trump, okay, but all politicians do that. We'll get your oil wells, we'll get your immigrants coming or whatever.
No, it's absolutely true. I mean, you can go back to the commentators about the Makot, about the 10 plagues, who ask why those plagues, and one of the standard approaches there is to say that this was done in the manner of war. In terms of depriving them of the resources and so forth. Absolutely. This is that is certainly one layer of what's going on. Susan. It can be. It can be. Sometimes chorai is used to refer to defecation. I mean, it's entirely possible that it could be used in that sense. Yeah, I don't think it's the only way to take it. No, and the standard approach that I've seen is not that. Don Mikra takes it as I did, that it's talking about the material that you're weaving out of the flax. But yes, it's a doable translation. Okay, so you've now seen the devastation of Egypt predicted in general, the overarching one, the sicking Egyptians against Egyptians. We've seen the Nile-based agriculture ruined. And then the next sentences, 11 to 15, are about the council of Egypt against the council of God. Council meaning C-O-U-N-S-E-L, advice, planning. Remember, one of the themes that unites all of the book of Yeshaya is the theme of divine Eitzah versus the Eitzah of idolatry. Eitzah, again, meaning counsel, like Utsu Eitzah Vitufar, which is, of course, Yeshaya. It's the idea that God sees, foretells what is going to happen in advance. Over and over again, in all parts of the book, from the beginning to the end, you find God saying, ask your idols whether they can tell you what's going to happen, because here's what's going to happen. So that's a major piece here. But I also think something that's going on at this section feeds in very well to Abarbanel. And I was surprised, Abarbanel didn't say it. Maybe he says that he has two places where he comments on this chapter. One is his commentary to Yeshaya, the other is in a work called Mashmia Yeshua. And maybe he said it there, but I don't think so. And that is, this is part three of Yitziat Mitzrayim. Remember what a big role the advisors played for Pharaoh? Right? Whether you're talking about where he summons them to emulate the miracles of Moshe and Aharon, and eventually they can't, or whether you go to the end of the story where they're telling Paro, let the Jews go already, right? The advisors play a very important role there in demonstrating God's victory. The same thing is true here. The advisors here have their counsel foiled. So take a look, starting with sentence 11 and running through sentence 15. Ach evilim sarei tzoan, chachmei yoatzei faro, eitzan niv'ara. Evilim is a term that either means fools or criminals. I don't know, what do you have in your translations? Do they do?
Fools.
Fools?
What? I have princes, actually.
You have princes? Huh. Oh, no, not Sarai, Evelyn.
Or other fools, yeah?
Yes, you have fools, sorry.
Yes, fools.
You have?
Bad people.
Bad people. Right. Is that really in your translation? No, but I'm just curious how they do the translation here. They do fools in the art scroll, I see. Yeah, I mean, Evelyn can be fools and it can be criminals. It can be taken either way. But the officers of Tsoan, Tsoan is a very important Egyptian city. The Torah talks about it as an ancient city of theirs, built 7 years after the ancient city of Hebron. Yeshaya, later on in chapter 30, is going to talk about it as the city where their nobles and their wise people live. So they all turn out to be foolish. Their counsel is foolish. Ech tomro el paro. How can you, in good conscience, say to the Pharaoh, Ben chachamim ani, ben malchei kedem, I am a descendant of scholars, I am a descendant of the kings of the east. How? What do you know? Ayam eifo chachamecha. Sentence 12. Where are they? Where is your wisdom? V'yagidu nalach. Let them tell you. V'yedu mayaatz Hashem tzvakos al Mitzrayim. Will they know what strategy God has developed against Egypt? No alu. Same term there, that Evil term. No alu sarei tzoan. Nishu sarei nof. The nobles of Tsoan have turned out to be foolish. Nishu is to be seduced or persuaded. The commentators connect it with Chava's term, Hanachash Hishiani. The snake persuaded me. Exactly. Sarei Nof, the officers of the nobles of Nof. Hisu es Mitzrayim Pinas Shivateha. The leaders of the tribes of Egypt misled Egypt. Here is something which I don't know if he's playing this game or not, but I have to wonder. When Yosef is in Egypt and he's in jail, he talks about how he was taken away. No, that's wrong. Sorry, not Yosef. Abraham. When Abraham first goes down to Egypt and he has to explain why it is that he lied about Sarah. So he says, Vayhiki hisu osi elokim mi beis avi. When God took me out of the house of my father, I made a deal with Sarah saying, wherever we go, say that you're my sister. So he used the word hisu to refer to how he was let out of his father's house, and now it's an unusual word. It's not a common word. And then Yosef actually, come to think of it, when the Torah describes Yosef looking for his brothers, what does it say? Vinei to'eb asadeh. Exactly. Yosef is wandering in the field. I wonder if Yeshaya isn't playing with that unusual term. Hisu es Mitzrayim pinat shivateh. The leaders of the tribes of Egypt misled her. Right? And it's just like Yosef when he was wandering. It's just like Avram when he was wandering. And both of them landed in Egypt. I wonder if that's part of the game that Yeshaya is playing here. To me, it can't be coincidental. By the way, that word pinat, we did this back in Nehemiah. Pinat, people, for some reason, render in Halil, today's Rosh Chodesh. Evan Maso Banim Aitala Rosh Pinah, they say that's the cornerstone. It's not a cornerstone. That's a mistranslation. Pinah is on top. That was what we talked about in the wall that Nehemiah built. And in fact, look at the sentence. How could it be that it's the bottom stone if it's Rosh Pinah? What does that even mean? Doesn't make any sense. It's not. It's the top stone. It's not the bottom. It's the top. And that's what he's saying here. Pinat Shivateha. We've seen it in Nehemiah. It comes up in Shoftim. It's just people mistranslate it. Sorry?
Why?
I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, Ibn Ezra says explicitly on Pinat Shabbatah here, he says, Gedolim, the leaders. I don't know why anybody would think anything otherwise. In Halil, they went into Hillim. Evan Masua Bonim, right, the stone that the builders rejected, Haitala Rosh Pinah became the top stone at the head. Capstone maybe, yeah, I don't know. But it's not the cornerstone. Cornerstones are always at the bottom.
Modern leaders. Modern leaders.
Yeah, so that's where you get. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. In any case, the however you do it, he says the counselors mislead Egypt. Pasuk Yudalit, sentence 14. Hashem masach bikirba ruach ivim. That's a word. God poured into her midst a spirit that misleads them, that misguides them. Rashi says teruf hadat, which suggests not just misleading them, but actually either frightening or confusing them. V'hisu es Mitzrayim b'chol ma'aseyo kehita os shikor b'kiyo. Boy, does he love this word. They mislead Egypt like somebody who is drunk being misled into his own vomit. Excuse the expression, but that's the expression. But he uses this term, this tough ayin hay, in four different forms inside of a sentence and a half. V'lo yeyele Mitzrayim ma'aseh asher ya'aseh. And Egypt is not going to have any strategy. They're not going to have any deed they can perform. Rosh v'zanav, head and tail, kipav v'agmon. There are different ways to render kipav agmon. Yeshaya likes the word agmon. It shows up in a bunch of different places in Yeshaya. I think at least three places. But here they render it. What do they do for kipav agmon in the art scroll?
The canopy.
Canopy to tree or the reed. What's the image? Sorry, head or tail is Rosh and Zanav.
Again.
The top and the bottom,
right. So that's the way that most commentators take it, is that the Rosh and the Kippah are the leaders, the Zanav and the Agmon are the followers. That's the Ibn Ezra, Radak along the same lines. Abarbanel says these are military positions. The point is that their military is demolished. Rashi, though, has this fascinating other read, which I had to bring you in source number 8. He says it's talking about the magicians and the counselors, who were the theme in this section. How in the world do you connect it to the counselors? Hema chartumim ve'itstegninim, hachozim v'kochavim sheyesh v'rakia mazalos v'kochavim hamechunim kein. He says, these are the people who scan the stars, because you have constellations and stars that have these names in the heavens. V'asim dugmat rosh v'zanav. They're in the shape of a head, the shape of a tail. So Rashi shows you how this can fit the overall theme of the counselors being led astray. This is saying that they will no longer have the ability to read future messages in the stars. So three stages to the demolition of Egypt. The destruction of their gods cannot help them. Number two, the Nile and the whole Nile-based economy. And number three, the loss of their counselors. And then you get the end of the chapter, sentences 16 to 25. So we're not going to get through all of this clearly in the next 8 minutes, but we'll see some things. The themes here in the last 10 sentences are Egypt comes to recognize God, and a future alliance develops between Egypt, Assyria, and Israel. And it's not wrong. Even though we keep saying, we've been saying this for 18 chapters, don't pursue alliances with everybody around you, here we will get a prediction of an alliance, and it's a good thing. When does this come true? It all depends on when you think this chapter is supposed to happen. Was this after the fall of Sennacherib? Was this the house of Chonio? Is this Mashiach's time? Certainly Abarbanel's argument is the one that's most compelling. This part no one sees happen in the Second Temple period. No one sees an alliance between Egypt, Assyria, and us during the Second Temple period. But this leads to a very important question, which I think I'd like to use the last several minutes to focus on. And that is, we're going to be talking about them building an altar to God, and praying to God, right? We've already referred to sentence 18, sentence 19. If you jump ahead really fast and you look at sentence 18, right? Five cities in the land of Egypt will speak the language of Canaan and will swear by God. There will be an altar to God. They're going to cry out to God in sentence 20, and God is going to save them. In sentence 21, they're going to make vows and bring sacrifices to God. You see that? And so on. It gets even better as you get to the end of the chapter. So the question that I have is one that we looked at a little bit when we read chapter 2. But since that was way back in the beginning of the year, right after Sukkot, no one, myself included, remembers what we said. So we can now revisit it and maybe get a little more understanding. Do we expect the nations of the world to convert to Judaism in the time of Mashiach?
We expect them to recognize God, not necessarily.
So Rebecca says, no, I don't expect them to convert. I expect them to simply recognize God. Now, we saw back in chapter 2 the prediction of the nation streaming to Mount Zion to learn the Word of God. I might have thought that there was some sense of conversion from various passages and Midrashim. However, I think you're correct. I think that it's not about conversion, it is about recognition of God. And I have several sources to support that claim. If you take a look at source number 9, as it happens, well, I see only one Thornhillian. I'm going to give a shiur on this on the first day of Yom Tov at the Bayit. If anybody is there for Tikkun Yom Shavuos, you're welcome to come to it 7:20. Oh, you'll be up north. Okay, so you'll hear more about this then. But if you take a look at source number 9, this is the most obvious evidence that we're not looking for the world to convert in the time of Mashiach. The Gemara says they can't. Tana Rabbanan, Ein Mekablim Gerim Limos HaMashiach. Sorry, store is closed. We don't accept converts in the time of Mashiach. There's more to be said about that because the Rambam says, yeah, but. There's evidence that we don't accept conversion. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah that I brought you in source number 10 predicts that it's based on a passage at the end of Zechariah that the nations are going to come to God and say, hey, wait a minute, it's not fair to judge us, we weren't given the Torah. Had we been given the Torah, we would have fulfilled it. And the Gemara envisions, again, based on the end of Zechariah, that they're going to be given the mitzvah of Sukkah. And then they're going to fail at the mitzvah of Sukkah, and that's going to demonstrate God's correctness in not giving them the Torah. The Ibn Ezra that I brought you in source number 11, again, based on those passages at the end of Zechariah, says that one third of the nations are going to become the servant of God, but it's not conversion. So I think that really the message here in Yeshaya should be understood in light of those other sources, which is he's not predicting conversion. He's predicting loyalty to God, belief in God, loyalty to God, even sacrifices to God. But the Torah has no problem with the nations of the world bringing sacrifices. The Torah has explicit laws about which sacrifices to bring and where and so forth. So what we're seeing here in our prediction is the recognition of God not becoming Jewish. That's the way to read it. So what we'll have to do, next week there is no class the day after Shavuos. Everyone will be tired from having learned so much Torah on Shavuos. But we will have, God willing, on the 18th. And I'd like to have class on the 25th if people are still around. We have to figure that out still. Janine, and we'll close with that. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask, it's very odd that you talk about Svakhanan.
Yeah, we're getting there. Oh. I'm not overlooking that. Svakhanan is very much a focus of this conversation.
My comment has nothing to do with you.
Okay, so I will.